Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the standoff at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which now has two acting directors. One, Leandra English, is the deputy to the outgoing director of the CFPB, Richard Cordray, and the other is an avowed enemy of the CFPB, Mick Mulvaney, who Trump has appointed as acting director. Dennis Kelleher, the president and chief executive officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets, joins us. We will discuss a bureau that has been under constant political assault from Republicans since it was created under the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, and how President Trump, who ran against Wall Street but has since proven to be the financial industry's most faithful servant, will reward Wall Street by crippling the most effective watchdog against financial abuse and predatory behavior that has resulted in 30 million American consumers collecting $12 billion in refunds. Then we'll examine the Pope's visit to Myanmar, Burma, and the delicate diplomacy underway with Burma's small Catholic community urging the Pope not to even utter the word Rohingya, despite global condemnation of the ethnic cleansing that has driven Burma's Muslim minority into neighboring Bangladesh, where their future in crowded refugee camps is uncertain. David Steinberg, a distinguished professor of Asian Studies Emeritus at Georgetown University and a former member of the Senior Foreign Service and author of Burma, the State of Myanmar, joins us to discuss how the Pope is trying to exercise his moral authority while not exposing Burmese Catholics to a backlash of persecution. Then finally, we'll speak with Christopher Masakano, a PhD candidate studying higher education policy in the Department of Leadership, Policy and Organizations at Vanderbilt University. He joins us to discuss his article at the Los Angeles Times. If the GOP gets its way on taxes, the party could doom postgraduate education in the U.S. and how the country's best and brightest who live on $25,000 per year will see a 400% increase in their taxes under the House GOP bill to offset tax cuts for the biggest corporations and the richest Americans. And joining us now is Dennis Kelleher, who is the president and chief executive officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog and has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dennis Kelleher.
Thanks, Ian. Nice to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us, Dennis. And what do you make of this standoff at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, where Mick Mulvaney has been named by President Trump as the acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau? He shows up there today with a bunch of donuts, but the person who the outgoing director appointed, Leandra English, is not leaving her job. So you've got two people claiming the same job. Pretty strange, isn't it?
Well, it is, but, you know, the strange has become normal under President Trump, who, as you and others have pointed out, Jeb Bush referred to as the chaos president, and he certainly is good at doing that. This, frankly, shouldn't surprise anybody. President Trump has been a stalwart ally of Wall Street in the financial industry since he got to the White House. Frankly, I don't think it's much of an overstatement to say that he's virtually merged the White House with Wall Street. And the financial industry in this country has hated the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau since the idea was first brought up in 2009 and discussed during the debate over what became the Dodd-Frank financial reform law. And let's remember what the debate is really about. Forget the personalities. The debate is about an incredibly effective consumer financial protection agency that in just a few short years has returned $12 billion to 27 million ripped-off Americans. And the financial industry is furious because those $12 billion were supposed to stay in their pockets. And instead, the Consumer Financial Protection Agency required the financial industry to take the $12 billion out of their pockets and put it back into the pockets of ripped-off Americans, 27 million of them. And that's why the financial industry has always targeted a real effective consumer protection agency. And that's what this fight is about. And the personalities should not obscure what's really at stake here. And that's the financial security and the money of hardworking Americans being ripped off by financial predators.
But what triggered this is clearly the resignation of Richard Cordray. And you know the Republicans have gone after him forever, and they tried to make a commission out of it so that it be neutered, and then they tried to stop him, his appointment. Why did he leave? There's no clarity about that. And did he leave in such a way to give Trump this opening?
Well, nobody knows really, except for Rich Cordray, why he left. But his term expired in, I believe, about 6 months. So he was out the door one way or the other in 6 months. So whether or not this happened today or in 6 months, I don't think is all that important. Whether or not the president succeeds in installing an acting director, or whether or not Rich Cordray's deputy takes over, it's still only a matter of time, and the courts will probably sort it out. And that's of some interest inside the Beltway, but I'm not so sure it's all that important to people outside the Beltway. What's interesting here is that the president is probably going to try and keep an acting director there for as long as possible, because what the Republicans and President Trump don't want is a public debate about killing one of the most effective consumer protection agencies in the history of the country. All the polls show that the American people, Democrats, Republicans, independents, and non-voters, overwhelmingly support consumer protection and consumer protection agencies. And of course they should. We know. So if you look at what the CFPB has done in a few short years under this director, the Bank of America was required to refund $727 million to consumers for deceptive marketing. Citigroup was required to return $700 million to consumers for illegal credit card practices. J.P. Morgan Chase, $300+ million, they had to refund the consumers for unfair billing, and the list goes on and on and on. And that's what's really at stake here. And unfortunately, President Trump, his Republican allies in Congress doing the bidding of the financial industry, is worried about financial institutions and not worried about consumers.
Right, but it seems to me that the bad guys are winning. Look what's looming out there, Dennis, at the moment. You've got the possibility that this pedophile can be elected to the United States Senate. You've got the possibility, a real possibility, that net neutrality will be repealed by Trump's guy, Ajit Pai, on the FCC. And you've got this absolutely obscene tax reform package that is so weighted to the rich and powerful corporations at the expense of middle class and poor Americans. It's clearly the donor's dream wish list come true, and that could pass too. So I don't know. I'm depressed about what's happening, frankly. I really see a really dark clouds here on the horizon.
Well, you know, there's plenty of reasons to feel depressed about the dark clouds on the horizon and, frankly, the dark clouds that have arrived. On the other hand, it's important, I think, to remember that Trump ran as the most anti-Wall Street presidential candidate since FDR in the 1930s. He painted Hillary Clinton as the stooge of Wall Street. He claimed that Hillary Clinton was going to let Wall Street run amok if she became president. And that's how he got elected. Millions of people in this country voted for the anti-Wall Street candidate, voted for the candidate they thought would be tough on finance. So what's interesting is he's come to office, and I often say that I don't think President Trump has ever met candidate Trump, because what he did is he's installed Goldman Sachs and mostly Wall Street people into senior positions and has run an agenda that's been pro-Wall Street from beginning to end. So there is hope here, because the American people still by majorities of both Republicans and Democrats believe that finance should be regulated and regulated to prevent another financial crash, and they also believe strongly in supermajorities on consumer protection. So what this president and this administration cannot withstand is an open, honest debate and discussion about what they're really doing, which is helping Wall Street at the expense of Main Street. And that's why it's so important not to get caught up in the personalities and kind of the lawsuits and this thing and that thing. It's to be focus on what the substance here is. And the substance here is that we have one of the most effective consumer protection agencies ever that's now under assault by a president who claimed to stand up for the little guy when all he really does is stand up for the biggest, most powerful financial institutions in the country. And if people focus on that and people talk about that, then the many people who voted for the candidate that they thought was not going to do that, hopefully will get the message, see the truth, and act appropriately in the next election.
But in terms of this having two directors of the or acting directors of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Mick Mulvaney, who Trump has appointed, and Ms. English, who the outgoing head deputized. So the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act has some kind of language, has it not, about that covers this, since it's an act, a law. Isn't there a procedure here about filling a vacancy? I believe it's not totally clear, but it does talk about an acting director steps in to fill any vacancy.
Well, it's a little, unfortunately, it's a little bit more ambiguous than that. The statute says that the deputy director at the CFPB will become the acting director in the absence or unavailability of the director. The problem or the argument is that the director is not absent or unavailable. He's gone. So, in fact, you have a vacancy. The statute does not say in all instances of a vacancy for any purpose at any time, then the deputy director shall become the acting director. It says only, not only, but it says in the absence or unavailability of the deputy director shall come in. And what the president is going to argue is that this is not the absence or unavailability, which is a subset of vacancies. This is, in fact, a vacancy. And he's going to take the position that because it's a vacancy, he's entitled under a different statute, which is the Federal Vacancies Act, that he's entitled to appoint a certain type of a person to that to be acting, and that Mick Mulvaney, who's the director of the Office of Management and Budget, is that type of person. And let's, of course, not forget what type of person Mick Mulvaney is. He actually called the CFPB, quote, sad, sick joke, close quote, and voted when he was in Congress to abolish the agency. And he's actually already today announced a 30-day halt on all civil penalties, all rulemaking activities, and all hiring, because they want to, quote unquote, fix the agency, which, of course, by fix the agency, they mean to make it serve the financial industry rather than protect consumers.
Well, it's who's going to win if there's this legal ambiguity?
Well, it's not clear who's going to win. The lawsuit was filed last night, although I think you should assume that the president will probably win this argument. And if he doesn't win it in the short term, as I said, Ian, he's going to win it in the long term anyway. But what he doesn't want to do is he doesn't want to have an open, honest public debate about protecting consumers or protecting Wall Street. And that's what they want to avoid by installing an acting director that doesn't have to go through the Senate confirmation process where there are hearings and people can talk about the record of whoever the president nominates versus the record of what the agency has to do. And one other thing I want to mention, Ian, is the Consumer Financial Protection Agency isn't important just to protect consumers here and there. It's also incredibly important to prevent another financial crash. You have to remember that financial predators ripped off unsuspecting and unprotected mortgage consumers in the years before the 08 crash. That's what gave the fuel and the kindling to the subprime mortgage bubble. It was basically all these mortgage lenders and mortgage mills backed up with Wall Street money that gave put out all sorts of tricks and traps in the mortgages that people didn't know about, and then fraudulently handed out mortgages all over the place. And then when they didn't do that, they fraudulently created mortgages that they shipped off and sold to Wall Street that packaged them into fraudulent derivatives that ended up being a subprime bubble. That all started with predatory conduct at the consumer level, at the street level. So the importance of the financial, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau isn't just to protect consumers and investors, which is incredibly important of itself, but it's also to prevent predatory conduct from going unpunished and undetected, which frequently lead to financial instability, financial fragility, and ultimately financial crashes, which we all pay for.
Well, there's a lot at stake, and you know, one hopes that, as I say, the bad guys are winning lately, Dennis, and I hope some good guys win. I really do. This is unbelievable, the rampant greed that's going on at the very top. The most powerful people in this country just siphon all this money from the middle class and the poor in this budget. I find it extraordinary. And combined with what you've told us about how Trump has ran as the guy that was going to bring Wall Street to heel and is now their most faithful servant, I mean, it's all so cynical.
Well, you're right about that, but the hope is that the American people will pay attention sufficiently enough when they're not working and trying to take care of the kids and trying to take care of their parents and kind of just live their life. They will see what this administration is doing, if the administration has not been on their side, that it's consistently siding with finance over their best interest. And this is an incredibly clear example of where consumers and investors who are going to be protected against financial predators actually is going to unleash financial predators. And hopefully that will be enough to get their attention and that they will pay attention, because it means an awful lot to their own pocketbooks.
Well, Dennis Kelleher, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dennis Kelleher, who is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog and has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the Pope's visit to Myanmar, Burma, and the delicate diplomacy underway.
You receive, but always want more. But the day is coming, the day is near, the day is coming, you know what I mean. The day is
see, yes, be rating what it feels, the global world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Steinberg, a distinguished professor of Asian Studies Emeritus at Georgetown University and a specialist on Burma, Myanmar, North Korea and South Korea, Southeast Asia, and U.S. policy in Asia. He previously served as a member of the Senior Foreign Service and as director for Philippines, Thailand, and Burma Affairs. His books include Turmoil in Burma, Contested Legitimacies in Myanmar, and Burma, the State of Myanmar. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Steinberg.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And what do you make of the Pope's visit to Myanmar? We know that this is a Pope that takes very strong, outspoken moral stances. We also know what's been going on there. The Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, has referred to the treatment of the Rohingyas as ethnic cleansing. And the Pope met today with the military chief and General Minh Aung Hlaing,
yes.
He denied that there was any religious discrimination going on in Rakhine State. So it's a little bit surreal. And my understanding is that people have been advising the Pope not to even use the word Rohingyas. So it's hard to understand how you could have a dialogue and not about the 900-pound gorilla in the middle of the room.
Well, it is a very complicated situation. There certainly is prejudice against both Muslims and Christians in the society. It doesn't mean that in the major cities of the country you cannot go to a mosque or a church. But it does mean if you look at the higher levels of power, colonel and above in the military, I do not believe there is either a Christian or a Muslim as either a colonel or above in the military, which is the center of power. There are now Christians in the parliament, but the National League for Democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi's party, did not nominate a Muslim for any one of its seats. So there is that kind of prejudice. Number two, on the Rohingya issue, this is very complicated and unique to Myanmar. The country has designated 135 ethnic groups or races in the country. This is a misnomer. They are really maybe 135 or so various linguistic variations of various ethnic groups. But the result is if you say that these people are Rohingya, then they can deserve, theoretically, citizenship under a 1982 law as one of the indigenous groups in the country. So they do not want to use that term. So the military call them Bengalis. And they should go back to Bengal, to Bangladesh. However, it is clear that if you talk to either the highest people in the government or even the very, very liberal younger people, the prejudice against the Rohingya is exceedingly strong. And there are very militant Buddhist groups that are against both Muslims and Rohingya especially. Now, this is even more complicated because the Rakhine area where the Rohingya are on the Bangladesh border, the Rakhine area was only conquered by the Burmans, the majority, in 1785. And the people of Rakhine, the Buddhists, were considered second-class citizens under the government in the past. So they feel, the Buddhists feel vulnerable. They feel vulnerable to the Burmans. They also feel vulnerable because the aid coming in is going to the Rohingya, the Muslims, and they feel left out. So this becomes a very complex situation that has become militarized in the past year, and that is makes the tragedy much worse.
Well, there are only 650,000 Catholics in Burma, Myanmar, a country of 53 million people.
Right.
And it is extraordinary. For example, the Jesuit priest Thomas Rees has argued that the Pope risks either compromising his moral authority or putting in danger the Christians of that country. And apparently the local Catholics have basically tried to tell the Pope, you know, for God's sake, don't use the word Rohingya.
Yeah, I have been criticized by Burman friends by using the term Rohingya in some of the things that in my conversations with them. Now, the Catholics in the country are mostly from minority groups, not from the Burman majority, which is 99% Buddhist. And it is very difficult to convert Buddhists to any other religion because it's a very strong religion. And so the minority groups, which are often animist, did get converted by the American Baptist Mission, various Protestant groups, and the Catholics as well.
So why is religion then so powerful in this country, or is it? I mean, at the end of the day, there is a civilian government, but most people think that Aung San Suu Kyi's powers are somewhat circumscribed by the generals who've ruled the place for a long time and are still, you know, they've got, I can't remember what percentage of the seats in the parliament they've designated for themselves, but they're clearly the power behind the throne, aren't they?
Well, first of all, the religion is terribly important, Buddhism, because it is the single most important legitimizing factor for any government. You have to be in favor of religion, and if you do a content analysis of the press over the years, you will see how important Buddhist activities by the leadership, whether it's civilian leadership or military leadership, has been it is critical to any legitimation of government. Secondly, the question is that the National League for Democracy, Aung San Suu Kyi's party, is essentially a Buddhist party. And no Muslim representatives in the legislature from that party. It is said that Aung San Suu Kyi wanted to nominate her lawyer, a man named Boni, who was assassinated at the Yangon airport some months ago. She wanted to make him attorney general, but he said that's not a good idea because you will get into so much criticism by supporting any Muslim in the government. So the prejudices run very, very strong. And I have suggested to one of the Vatican newspapers that called me on this several weeks ago that one of the things that the Pope might do was to stress the commonality of Buddhist and Christian ideology in terms of the fairness, equality, compassion, and that sort of thing. There is a link there that is important that the Pope could stress if he wanted to.
Well, the Pope, of course, was greeted on the tarmac at the same airport, by the way, by Cardinal Charles Mong Bol, the local archbishop. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, he went and visited with the military leader. I also understand that wasn't there also a meeting between Aung San Suu Kyi and the leader of Bangladesh, where the flood of refugees has almost, 750,000 suddenly on this impoverished country's doorstep. What do you think went on in those meetings?
Well, first of all, Bangladesh doesn't want these people. Right. And they have said, somebody said, I can't tell you who, I can't remember who, said, well, the ones that remain, they ought to be sent to an island in the middle of the estuary on the Bay of Bengal and set aside, because when those islands get hit by the monsoons and the typhoons every year, and it's, you know, a terrible, terrible place for people to live. But they don't want them in the country. So they'd be delighted to see them go back. But the Burmese, ethnic cleansing was the right term. Now, if you go back a month or so ago, Patrick Murphy, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, testified by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and he was prodded by a congressman named Connolly, a Democrat from Northern Virginia, saying, isn't this ethnic cleansing? Isn't this ethnic cleansing? And Murphy refused to say that. Now Tillerson, basically a month later, has said that. And I believe it is, in fact, ethnic cleansing. It is not genocide, but it is a clear idea that people, Burmese, do not want these guys in the country, but they're not about to give any land up also. So the land area has to remain intact under the Constitution and in the views, I think, of most Burmese, but they don't want these people in the country.
And neither do the Bangladeshis, right? Or
exactly. Well, these are stateless people. I think they are the worst off of any people in East or South Southeast Asia. They have been discriminated against. And the problem becomes this for the United States in terms of policy. Supposing you... Senators Cardin and McCrae put in proposed a bill for sanctions against some of the military and military institutions. Well, once you put those sanctions in, what's going to happen? Supposing these people, a lot of them do go back, and supposing there is no violence, but suppose they still live in poverty, without rights, without proper employment, clearly discriminated against, will these sanctions be lifted then? And I think the answer would be no, that there would be outrage, continuing outrage about that. And that becomes a problem, because when you introduce these sanctions, you have to have a clear idea of what it will take to get rid of the sanctions. And we have that problem in a number of countries. Do we really think that Russia's going to give back Crimea? I don't think that's in the cards.
Right. No, particularly given the enormous investment in the land bridge that they're building.
Right.
So what, though, is happening in the broader sort of geopolitical sphere in terms of competition between China and the United States for influence. For the longest time, the generals were tied in with the Chinese, but then there was an initiative under Obama, which I think in part led to Aung San Suu Kyi being the leader of the country, or they call it a de facto leader. Perhaps it is some kind of fig leaf. I'm not sure exactly how much power she has. But
well, she has power over the cabinet and a certain amount of power in the parliament. Mm-hmm. But the military control directly under the Constitution by active duty military, not only the Department of Defense, I mean the armed forces directly, but three key ministries. One, defense, which is obvious. Second, minority affairs, which is terribly important in that country since a third of the population are minorities. And third, the Ministry of Home Affairs. Now, the Ministry of Home Affairs has three terribly important components. One is the police, obvious. Second, intelligence. And the third, the bureaucracy. The bureaucratic level, the civil service, if you will, from the central government to the village, is controlled by the Ministry of Home Affairs, which must be under the command of a military, active-duty military officer. So Aung San Suu Kyi's control over the country is very, very limited. In fact, it is, let us say, a dual government, a government where Min Aung Hlaing, the head of the commander-in-chief of the army, and Aung San Suu Kyi have important roles. They do not like each other. They do not get along. And Aung San Suu Kyi, in my view, she has said, in fact, I am not a democratic icon. I am a politician. But she's not a very good politician, because if she were a good one, she would try to make sure that she's on good terms with the military. But she's tried to confront the military at every stage, or outflank them. In fact, her own title as a state counselor was not in the Constitution. She created that title, which, as she says, is above the president of the country.
But hasn't she lost some of her moral luster, the idea that she's a hero and the fact that she is a Nobel Prize winner? Her silence over the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingyas has surely damaged her standing around the world.
It has damaged her standing exceedingly badly around the world. There's no question about that. Now, it has damaged her standing inside the country to some degree, but because she is running the country, I mean the bureaucracy, I'm sorry, the policy issues, she has, everything has come to a stagnation or constipation, if you will. Nothing can get done. She is in charge of or on 16 specific committees, ministries, and so forth. So all decisions are made by her or approved by her, which means she can't do it. I mean, it's physically impossible, mentally impossible for anybody to do these things. And she's a very smart person. There's no doubt about that. I've known her since 1985, and I have great respect for her intelligence and her tenacity. But at the same time, this personalization of power has meant that reforms that are even asked for, wanted, are not being implemented because everybody's afraid to do anything that might antagonize her.
Well, just back to the question I had about geopolitical influence. The Chinese...
Yeah, I want to go back to that. That's a critical question.
Right. The Chinese seem to have overstepped a little bit with the dam, etc. Obama seemed to have a bit of an initiative now, but as we know, Donald Trump has no regard for human rights. He's totally transactional. So is it a case of the U.S. has lost influence there or through negligence?
I think the U.S. has been concentrating on democracy issues, rule of law, good governance, that sort of thing. Those are what we are interested in. And better minority relations, of course. These are very important things, no question. But at the same time, the Chinese have been doing infrastructure, and the Chinese feel that as one Chinese put it to me, U.S. assistance to Myanmar is like beautiful moonlight on the river. There's nothing there but except it looks nice. But the Chinese do not want to play the critical role. The American ambassador, former American ambassador, said this publicly, that he was told by the Chinese ambassador not to go to Kachin State, that means the China border area, because the Chinese didn't want the Americans mucking around with the minorities on the China border. And, of course, the American ambassador, the first thing he had to do was to go to the border, just to show that the United States is autonomous in these sorts of actions. But the Chinese have, I think, five principles that apply to North Korea, by North Korea and to Myanmar at the same time, among other countries, the peripheral countries. One, they want a peaceful border. Two, they want no refugees. That's important to keep out the UN High Commissioner for Refugees in their country. Three, they want, of course, Chinese public and private business. Four, they want neighbors to vote with them in UN and other fora. And five, most importantly, they don't want any Americans on the border. They don't want American influence there.
And how about access to resources? How about access to resources?
Well, the Chinese want access to resources, but they want access to the Bay of Bengal. And this is a critical thing. The Chinese are building what they call a blue water navy. And part of that is to have access to the Bay of Bengal. And the Chinese have established what they call, we call the String of Pearls, which are ports in the Indian Ocean, which they can refuel ships and have some influence. These are not bases, not military bases. But Gandhar in Pakistan, Hambantota, I think, in Sri Lanka, in Chittagong, in Bangladesh, Jokpu, in Burma. These are places that the Chinese have strong influence, and the Chinese are trying to establish on the Bay of Bengal border at Jokpu in Rakhine a major industrial zone, as the Japanese have done outside of Yangon. And the idea here is that this is port, Jokpu, is also the site of the terminus of two pipelines that go from the Bay of Bengal through Myanmar to Kunming. One is for crude oil from the Middle East, and the second is offshore Burmese natural gas.
Well,
so there's an important Chinese penetration, if you will, of Myanmar.
Right.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And the U.S. has no such role. And U.S. business, because of the instability, the concerns, and the past sanctions, has not invested as much as one might have thought they would have.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, good luck, huh?
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And I've been speaking with David Steinberg, a distinguished professor in Asian Studies Emeritus at the Georgetown University. He has previously served as a member of the Senior Foreign Service and as Director for Philippines, Thailand, and Burma Affairs. And his books include Turmoil in Burma, Contested Legitimacies in Myanmar, and Burma, the State of Myanmar. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with a PhD candidate who lives on $25,000 per year, but will see a 400% increase in his taxes under the House GOP bill, meant to offset tax cuts for the biggest corporations and the richest Americans. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Christopher Masakano, who's a PhD candidate studying higher education policy in the Department of Leadership, Policy and Organizations at Vanderbilt University. His research interests include higher education policy and finance, politics and public opinion. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times, "If the GOP gets its way on taxes, the party could doom postgraduate education in the United States." Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Marsicano.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the grad student tax.
Well, it's an extraordinary and shocking development. The idea that, for reasons which I can't understand, I know that both the Senate and the House GOP bills are largely driven by donors. And in fact, a number of Republicans have come forth, including Senator Lindsey Graham, basically saying that the donors are saying, if you don't get this passed, don't call us for money again. So to that extent, we know who's driving this bill, the donors. But what could possibly explain why the rich and powerful in this country would want to destroy higher education? Why would they want to make it impossible for PhD students to make a living? Is there some peculiar anti-intellectual bent here? Is there any logic behind it?
So first off, I want to say I'm not sure that I agree completely that this is all based on donors. I think there are a number of provisions within both the House and Senate tax cut bills that may actually increase our research, thinking about corporate tax, corporate tax reductions. If corporations then take some of those savings and put them into R&D, that could be good for research. But I do have to say there are three sort of major provisions in the House bill that really impact higher education. The first is a tax on endowments of private institutions, about a 1.4% tax on endowment earnings, keeping in mind that the bulk of those earnings go to scholarships and operating expenses. And this is for endowments of $250,000 or more per student and for schools that have at least 500 students. But that still impacts a lot of places in your listening area, like the Claremont Colleges, for instance. Another is a tax on licensing revenue from college sports logos. So the money which would normally go to fund athletic scholarships for students will also be taxed, and that'll definitely take a hit at places like the University of Southern California. But the one area that we've been talking about and that the LA Times article is about is a tax on grad students. And what I mean by that is currently grad students receive both scholarships and fellowships of around $25,000 a year. Sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less, but that's effectively their take-home pay. At especially private elite universities and some public universities, they may also have their tuition waived, which at a place like USC or the Claremont Graduate School means that that universities would normally charge students around $55,000, $60,000, and then instead of that, they just waive that fee, basically meaning the students can go without having to pay tuition. So their take-home pay is about $25,000, and their tuition waiver is around $55,000. And so what you end up having is students are taxed on $25,000, not the total amount. Well, currently the House bill, and specifically the House bill, I want to be very clear on this, the House bill wants to tax that tuition waiver. So effectively tax people who are making around $25,000 like they are making $80,000, which would bankrupt a lot of graduate students. Now, I don't think that this was designed to specifically hurt higher education. I think this was shaking the couch cushions to see what changes there in order to make way for corporate tax cuts and income tax cuts. But it would dramatically hurt grad students and their ability to do the hard-hitting research that they do, the cutting-edge work that they do, to try to find a cure for cancer or to understand the psychological processes behind criminal behavior. Without this kind of funding, it could dramatically hurt colleges and universities' ability to do that work, to recruit and retain and educate talented individuals who want to make a difference through their research. I'm hopeful that this will get taken out of the final bills. We already have some examples of members of the House who voted for the House bill sort of beginning to walk back or expressing reservations that the final version of the bill won't include tuition waiver taxes. Specifically, the Salt Lake Tribune reported last week that Representative Mia Love from Utah is interested in taking that out of the final bill. but it does bring attention to a broader question that you mentioned here, which is, what is the role of higher education and investment of higher education in this country? And we have seen declining public support for higher education in terms of financial funding. But as far as conservative individuals or politicians being supportive of higher education, while polling data shows that conservatives and specifically Republicans are less inclined to support higher education than they were before, they still make sure to go to the college football game on Saturday, and they still love their own institutions, their alma maters, I think is the Latin plural. They still love the alma mater. They still want to make sure that universities thrive, especially the ones that they love. It's a bit of a paradox, but it is certainly the case. Polling data shows us.
But the idea that students like yourself, and many of whom are married, I mean, it's pretty hard to imagine how you can live on $25,000 a year, frankly. But the idea that you're going to be taxed on $80,000 income instead of the $25,000, which is your actual income, in other words, you're getting a 400% increase in your taxes in order to offset or to find some money, and it can't be that much money we're talking about here, in total, to offset cuts in taxes for large corporations and wealthy individuals. That is the bottom line, is it not?
I think it's certainly part of a more comprehensive plan. I haven't spoken to legislators. I've certainly spoken to higher education institutions, and that is the feeling of many leaders of higher education institutions, but others don't necessarily agree with that. I haven't spoken to legislators, so I can't tell exactly what is in their minds when it comes to this. I will say that I do think that this particular provision, the grad student tax, I am hopeful that it will not be included in the final bill because it affects about a fourth of all PhD students, and that's a very small number of students over the country at all, a very impactful number of students. Let's be very clear here. These people are doing incredible work that will, I believe, change the world for the better with their research and their teaching and their building of civic capacity within their students. But it's a very small number of students, which means that I can't imagine that it's going to bring that much tax revenue. So I'm hopeful that in the final version of the bill, we will see either a change in this tax, in this tuition waiver, or elimination of a tuition waiver tax altogether.
Well, you mentioned earlier that both the House and Senate bills would make it harder to itemize charitable contributions, and that could reduce giving philanthropy to nonprofit universities by as much as $13 billion, and you mentioned the Claremont colleges. Surely you also have to put that in the broader context, don't you, Christopher, that by eliminating the estate tax, that is going to do a massive blow to the tradition of American philanthropy. There'll be no incentive for the very, very wealthy to pass their money on, like the Ford Foundation, the Rockefellers, going back into the history of even the robber barons, that the wealthy families of today will, in fact, in the president's case, the money will be going to Ivanka and Donald Jr. and Eric, not to, there'll be no incentive to invest in, I think Wharton is the college that Trump went to. So isn't that something that you have to contextualize into this broader picture?
Sure. I'm not an expert on the estate tax. What I do know about it is the research, fabulous research I've seen on framing that if you call it a rich kid tax, people are more interested in supporting it. And if you call it an estate tax, people are more interested in opposing it. But I can't speak to how the estate tax fits in the broader area of the tax bill. My expertise is on the higher education politics and policy part of the tax bill. I certainly am sympathetic to the idea that the estate tax, the death tax, the rich kid tax, whatever it is called, was enacted in order to make sure that we don't have generations of oligarchy, and I'm certainly sympathetic to that cause, but I don't necessarily know, because I haven't run the numbers, because it's not my area of expertise, how that fits into the overall tax bill.
Well, let's talk then about the context of American higher education being the envy of the world, and how the rankings of international universities have always had the U.S. up there at the top. But for the first time in the 14-year history of the Times Higher Education Ranking of International Universities, two non-U.S. institutions have come in first and second, right? And then only third and fourth places went to American universities, Caltech and Stanford. So what does that tell you?
Well, I think it tells us a number of things. The first is that during the Great Recession, we had a massive, how do I want to put this? We had a very difficult time for higher education in the United States. Some of our greatest institutions in America are large public universities, places like the University of California at Los Angeles and the University of California at Berkeley. These are fantastic institutions that do real good in the world. And during the Great Recession, institutions like those across the country received huge public divestment. In order to balance state budgets, those institutions were given less money in their total budget, and in turn had to pass those expenditures on to students. So we've had a period of time where at the same time, nations like China, parts of the UK as well, were finding new ways to fund higher education and spending a lot of money doing it. And it's expected that within the next 3 years, China will overtake the United States in terms of percent of GDP focused on research and development. So there's a very big concern that I think Americans should have about their higher education institutions. For the post-World War II era, American higher education has truly been the envy of the world. People from all over the world have come to the United States to come to school, to be educated, do cutting-edge research, and also to spin off new ideas into businesses and to invest in their community through higher education. We are getting to the point where that is becoming harder and harder to do. That first mover advantage is getting smaller and smaller. And if we don't find new ways to fund and support higher education, we will get lost. We will be caught behind sort of the rising giants of China and institutions, especially in the UK, that have new revenue streams. For a while, they did not charge tuition. Now they do, and they're continuing to be supported through their national government funding. So we've got to find new ways to fund higher education. We've got to increase investment in it. There are some institutions that are doing really innovative things. I think about Arizona State in particular, that are trying to find new ways to educate, new ways to do this new research. And we as a society have got to double down on our higher education institutions if we want to keep that competitive edge.
And who are the first and second place winners then in this higher education ranking of international universities?
You know, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I think it is Oxford and Cambridge. I think it's the Oxford schools in the United Kingdom.
Right. And you're saying that their revenue stream has changed. They're starting to charge, although they've found other revenue streams apart from government subsidies.
Right. They were in a very different situation. So they didn't charge tuition and now do. And so they have added this entire new funding. Also, the European Union has been a huge boon to the UK's universities, especially Scottish universities and the two universities in Northern Ireland have done an excellent job of, quote unquote, punching above their weight class, receiving more research funding than the UK puts in.
Well, but one of the things that I find extraordinary, though, in terms of the education budget in this country, I think between $30 and $40 billion of taxpayer money goes to these for-profit colleges who have an appalling record of piling up student debt, indenturing kids for life, and then giving them worthless diplomas. I mean, there seems like there are pots of money out there where you could actually do good by taking money away from these sort of rip-off institutions and investing them. I mean, surely in the broadest sense, we should be looking at our students and our postgrad students as centers of investment, not as centers of profit.
I couldn't agree more with the idea of looking at our university students, both undergraduate and graduate levels, as a source of investment. I will caution. I think that for-profit education has worked very well in other parts of the world, and I think that there are certainly some institutions that are for-profit in the United States, like American Public University or American Military University, which have similar graduation rates to a lot of public and nonprofit institutions. So I just want to be careful. Again, I'm in this world all day, every day, and so I just want to be careful about saying, yes, there are many institutions that do not have a great track record when it comes to graduation rates and job placements, but that is not a for-profit institution problem alone. A lot of public institutions and a number of nonprofit institutions also have that problem. We must do a better job of preparing our undergraduate students to graduate and providing the services they need so that they can get through this tough world of college and university life.
Well, just in closing, what can our audience do to influence the House bill? The Senate have not included this provision to quadruple the tax or a 400% increase in the taxes by basically charging students who live on $25,000 a year an annual income of about $80,000. On the surface, it seems so outrageous. I'm still astounded. That's why I wanted to talk to you. But what would you recommend our listeners do?
Sure. So this is an area where I feel comfortable talking about my research because it is specifically in political advocacy around higher education. I study higher education lobbyists. Most colleges and universities have a lobbyist on staff or an external lobbyist that they hire. And so I talk with these people all day, every day. And what I hear from them is the most effective tactic to sort of combat a major policy issue is first and foremost to thank the people who need thanking, to express gratitude, which means that if you live in a state where there is a senator who is on the Senate Finance Committee, give them a call. Thank them for not including a tax on tuition waivers. My mother always says that you catch more flies with honey than with vinegar. This is absolutely a great time to follow that advice wholeheartedly and to call people and thank them for their hard work in making sure that this doesn't end up in the Senate bill. As far as the House bill is concerned, it's a great opportunity for you to engage civically, to call, to email your House member, explain specifically why you oppose the bill, and be kind. One of the things that I've found incredibly frustrating when I've talked with legislative aides, most of whom are right out of college or are working in their second job working for a senator or a House member, they get yelled out of the phone on the phone, and it's not them who are making these decisions. Relay your message calmly, concisely, pleasantly, and thank the legislative aide whose number you call for their time, because these people work very hard, and it's really important that they know that you respect and are thankful for their hard work on behalf of the people. Reminding House members, basically, that, yes, among your constituents are graduate students. Among your constituents are people who are working really hard to cure cancer, to find new solutions to old problems like climate change. These are the people we need to be investing in, not that we need to be taxing. I teach a public policy class at Vanderbilt, and I always tell my students, you want to encourage things through incentives and discourage things through taxes. So let's not discourage graduate education, because it is what gets us the kind of research and innovation that will continue to give this country a competitive edge in the world.
Well, Christopher Masakano, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. I've really enjoyed being on Background Briefing.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Christopher Masakano, who's a PhD candidate studying higher education policy in the Department of Leadership, Policy, and Organizations at Vanderbilt University. His research interests include higher education policy and finance, politics, and public opinion. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times, "If the GOP Gets Its Way on Taxes, the Party Could Doom Postgraduate Education in the U.S. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.